This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The legislature has been a busy place this past month for lawmakers and for protesters. The demonstrators are made up of North Carolina NAACP members, local community organizers, and others who may not have considered themselves activists until now. The tie that binds them together is a concern over what they see as an extreme move to the right. They're singing, chanting, raising signs, and getting arrested.
We fight, we fight, we fight!
We do what?
We fight, we fight, we fight!
We do what?
We fight, we fight, we fight!
Can I have your attention?
We fight, we fight, we
fight! I'm asking you to listen.
We fight, we fight, we fight!
We do what?
We fight!
These demonstrations are called Moral Mondays, and they're growing larger every week. Since April 29th, 153 people have been arrested at the legislature. Larnese Taylor and Jacqueline Dowd Hall were arrested as part of the civil disobedience. They join us on the program now to talk about Moral Mondays and what inspired their participation. Larnese Taylor is vice president of local UE150 labor union. Jacqueline Dowd Hall is a history professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Larnese and Jacqueline, welcome to both of you. Good to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Larnese, tell us what made you decide to join this protest.
First, I want to say it's Larnese.
Thank you very much, and forgive me. Forgive me.
Not a problem. Not a problem. Because of the budget cuts and the attacks, not just on labor, but on the whole North Carolina citizens. I had to step up and do my part. The cuts are draconian. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And if we sit still, be quiet and silent, it's going to continue.
Well, tell me, Larnese, I know you've been a community organizer for a while. Have you ever been involved in civil disobedience?
No, this is my very first time.
Was it a difficult decision for you to decide?
No, it was not.
No?
No, it was not infringing on my rights. It was not a difficult decision at all.
Jacqueline, before you did civil disobedience, you said you'd been trying to organize and speak out in other ways. Tell us about that.
Well, just in all the ways that you can as a citizen, writing letters to the editor, signing petitions, writing letters to my representatives, voting, giving money to campaigns, so and so on.
What moved you to civil disobedience?
I feel that there was no other way to get attention of the legislators. There's been an avalanche of laws. I can't even name all the bad things that have happened in the legislature in the last month or the last year, and they add up to just I think from the point of view of a citizen and a historian. Just disaster for this state.
When you say you can't name them, you mean from memory, but you have a list of them.
Yes.
That motivated you.
Yes.
Motivated you to do this. I want to be clear about that.
Yes.
What about you? The decision to actually get arrested, did you have to pause and think about that?
I didn't hesitate, but I should be clear that my goal was not to be arrested. My goal was to join in a peaceful protest and to exercise my constitutional right to assembly and petition my government for redress of grievances. I don't think I should be asked to leave the legislative building before I'm able to hold up a sign or make a speech or make my opinions known, and I didn't intend to leave if asked.
Well, Larnese, I guess that is one question. What is it that you've actually been charged with?
Disobedience, not trespassing yet because I haven't gone back to my traffic, but disobedience, loud chanting, loud stuff like that. It's really a misdemeanor, which I'm ready to go back and do it again, you know.
I see.
It's going to make a difference.
Let me ask you, Jacqueline, if about that in particular. There, you certainly do have rights to assemble. You have rights to be in the legislature. Is any part of this this action now aimed at sort of getting broader rights to be there and to demonstrate?
For me, yes. That's not the major point of these demonstrations. The major point is to draw attention to policies that we think are very wrong and damaging. But we are also drawing attention to our right to speak and to be heard.
Larsine, you and others are in the UE 150 have been particularly watching how workers are going to be affected by recent legislation or proposed legislation anyway. Tell us about that in particular.
Yes. Well, as you, I'm sure you know, collective bargaining is already a ban against that within the North Carolina. But they wanted to make the law to inscribe it in the Constitution. Now, how far back do you want to take us? Okay. They also want to decrease unemployment benefits. They want to gut the State Personnel Act, which is the grievance system. They want to just take that away from us. We already don't have any rights, but they want to just go further with that. Now, we just won the right for the Charlotte City workers. This has been a 50-year struggle to get dues checkoff for those members there. We won that, okay? Now they want to put a law in that bans that, strips away. You can't pay, your union dues cannot be payroll deductible. All that is aimed at dismantling the union, destroying it. That's our resources, and that's what that's aimed at. Now realizing that they fear us coming together, you know, really challenging these rights. These are basic human rights that we're being denied.
And certainly this is not a labor-friendly state.
No, the least unionized state in the nation. Yes, indeed.
Well, and that's the thing, Larsine. What they're saying, I think, is that if we are too well-organized, it's going to discourage business and ultimately discourage jobs. So, you know, unions are bad for business. I guess that's the message we're getting from the legislature. What do you say to that?
And that's why it was so important that labor showed up on that third wave. That was our time. And I was glad I was able to step up. And we got to get the rest of the organized and unorganized workers to stand up, take a stand. Labor is on the rise in North Carolina. And that's the only way we're going to defeat this draconian legislation we're dealing with.
Well, let's ask.
We have to shine light on these laws. They're just unjust laws.
Well, let's ask about that. And this is, I guess, what I want to talk about now is whether labor is on the rise. Is this form of organizing, which we haven't seen for quite a while, and these kinds of demonstrations, is it a flash in the pan, or is there some deeper organization, more sustainable and sustained organization that's going on around this?
Yes, sir, buddy. Yes, sir, buddy, there is. This is like we're on a diving board, and we got that spring now to dive in with some force, and we're gathering.
Jacqueline, you have studied, you are not only a participant in this, but as part of your work as a historian, you've studied the history of these movements. Is there anything about this that has antecedents and that suggests to you that it might be sustainable?
There are so many antecedents. The civil rights movement, of course, is the one that people know best. And I think there are many analogies to what happened during the civil rights movement. It's very easy for people to now look back on the civil rights movement and say, oh, that was a good thing. And then they turn right around and react to these acts of civil disobedience in the same way that they reacted to the peaceful sit-ins at lunch counters and so on during the civil rights movement.
Who's the target audience in this? I'll start with you, Jacqueline. Are you trying to persuade the Republican majority to change their mind? Is that what's going on down there?
Well, we hope that people, the Republican majority, will listen to us and will at least have take pause and think that it might be a good idea not to make laws in an echo chamber, to actually talk to people who are not part of your sort of little inner circle that talks only to each other. But I don't have a whole lot of hope that we are going to be able to turn around the lawmakers anytime soon. So I think our major audience really is the public or the citizens of North Carolina.
Is that how you feel about it, Larsine?
Somewhat. I just want to add that at some point we have to prick the consciousness of the legislators. They got to see that what they're doing, what they're trying to do, it's immoral, it's wrong, it's just not right. They got to get a conscience at some point. We're not going to let up.
Well, Yeah, I agree completely. But I would add, too, that I think there are people in the General Assembly on both sides of the aisle mm-hmm. who are thoughtful and who are willing to listen. And that's the other purpose that we have, is to give heart to those people and to support those people.
You said, Jacqueline, though, that this is they're talking to themselves. They're in an echo chamber. They were elected. They were elected by the people of North Carolina. The people have spoken. I mean, can't they come back to you and say, you have the minority here in this atrium. The people of North Carolina said they want us here.
That is such a narrow way of thinking about how democracy works. It is just so untrue. If our democracy worked in the way that formulation describes, you would go to the polls once every 4 years, once every 2 years, cast your vote. Of course, a might very small. We have a low turnout in this country in comparison to other countries to begin with. We have redistricting, which has meant that if it was just plain old majority rule, the Democrats would be the majority party in the House right now.
That's because more people voted for Democrats in the last election in North Carolina than voted for Republicans.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. But beyond that, these men and women are all of our representatives. And just because an election goes in a certain way does not mean that as a citizen I should then sit back, not express my opinion, have nothing to do with the political process until another election comes around.
We're going to take a break right now on the state of things. But first I want to thank you, Larsine, for being on the program. Larsine Taylor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jacqueline Dowd Hall will stay with us after the break. She is a history professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Larsine Taylor is vice president of Local UE 150 Labor Union. Our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about civil disobedience and taking a look at the recent Moral Mondays in the State General Assembly. Moral Mondays have been bringing out more than the familiar faces of NAACP members and other local organizers. Moral Mondays have been pulling in people like Adam Sotak.
I have a 3-year-old and an 8-month-old at home. That's part of the reason that I participated in this on Monday. I'm angry and embarrassed as well. And I'll just say one thing. White people, if you think that you're not under attack as well, and you're not going to feel the pain, you're in for a rude awakening. It's time to turn off the Fox News, wake up, get active, get involved, and join the people that are going to help you have a better life here in North Carolina, because it's under attack.
And I should say that Adam Sotak appeared to be a white person from the YouTube video where we got this audio. We are joined today by Neil Caron to talk about what sets Moral Monday apart from other protests that we've seen in North Carolina in recent years. Neil Caron's a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Neil, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Where do these protests fit? I mean, in particular, the recent protests, compare it to the Occupy movement. Again, a movement where people got together, went somewhere, and expressed themselves.
Sure. I mean, in some ways, it's similar. It's a whole bunch of people gathering in a center. Many Occupies were at the state capitol. And so in that way, it's quite similar. It's a little bit different in that movement was sort of much more amorphous as far as fighting for inequality and against inequality in general, and also a lot more concerned about process, making sure that they themselves would be organized in a very sort of democratic way, whereas this is much more specific policy focused.
Right. So we're going to use the existing process, the legislative process, and try to move that with some kind of leverage. And that leverage is demonstrations bringing attention. What do you think is the impact? Does it have its greatest impact on lawmakers, on the public? Where do you see it working?
I think that it's in order to be successful, its impact is going to have to operate on a number of levels. And one of the primary ways that a movement gets its message out is through the media, either through the traditional media, you know, and there's been lots of stories in the various newspapers and on the radio about this movement. So in that way, it's been quite successful, certainly in getting the message out that it exists. The way it's framed itself as Moral Mondays, it's catchy, that it's routine, that it's has an increasing number of people participating, gives this sense of sort of excitement that is appealing to, that piques the interest of probably the average news reader.
There's a lot of legislation on the table here. And so while it's far more focused than the Occupy movement, it is in many ways diverse in the number of topics that it takes. What impact does that have on a movement like this?
Well, so on the plus side, it helps the movement get lots of people out there. If it was just about unions and union protections, it probably would be centered on just union members and supporters, which is a smaller subset of the folks. On the other hand, since it's about a broad range of issues, it draws in a whole host of different people and organizations to be a part of the coalition. On the other hand, that makes getting its message out much trickier, right? So the average person isn't sure, like, well, what's the most important issue other than, you know, this general sense of opposition to the Republicans. I think it's portraying that very effectively. But it is very tricky to portray when the list of things that you oppose is, you know, too long to mention, it's tough to get out any three or four of those.
I'm talking to Neil Caron, a professor of sociology at UNC Chapel Hill, and we're talking about Moral Monday, part of a long international legacy of civil disobedience. Jacqueline Dowd Hall rejoins the program to talk about the role of civil disobedience here and abroad, and also historically. Jacqueline Dowd Hall, a history professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and was one of those arrested as part of Moral Mondays. So, you know, you heard Neil talk about getting the message out, but these days, obviously, social media, very important. You made the connection between this and the civil rights movement of the middle of the 20th century. Does the way media has change the way you have to organize to try to get public attention these days? In other words, is this kind of a movement an anachronism in the era of social media or not?
I don't think so. Of course, social media is a big change, and it has made it possible for people to get the word out to their friends and their networks, and then those networks build into other networks in a way that couldn't happen during the civil rights movement in exactly that way. But at the same time, the media was critical to the civil rights movement in the same way that the media is critical to this movement.
Neil, how do you see it playing out in terms of just the changes over time that have taken place in technology and the way we communicate?
So I would agree that it's both the same and different. And so one of the ways is, you know, communication, that you can, and particularly before you go to an event, you can post on a Facebook page that you're going, or for the Facebook group will, you know, list all the people who are going. And so then you know, like, oh, look, there's already 15 people committed to get arrested, there's already 700 people who said they've attended. I'm going to go there. I'm not going to be the only one. So this reduces the costs and lessens the fear associated with going to a protest, particularly if you've never gone to something like this before.
Well, and it revives the idea of putting your body on the line and sharing and going to a shared space, because one of the things that social media has made it a little too easy to do is to like a movement and even to donate to a movement, but again, from the safety of your own home. This does bring back the kind of common space, common ideals that was part of those earlier movements, Jacqueline.
I think that is such an important point. And to me, that's one of the things I was trying to break through, is that I have a lot of friends, know a lot of people who are very interested in politics, who are following these things very closely, who are sitting in their homes, liking and signing and so on. And I wanted to step forward specifically to encourage those very people to actually show up with a group of people face to face. And I think it was a revelation to people who had never done that before, to a new generation.
The other thing, and one of the things Neil talked about, is the difficulty of bringing people together over a diverse range of issues. But you've talked about the idea that many people see themselves as the heirs to a progressive past in North Carolina. Is that a kind of branding, in a sense, that you have to do for the whole movement to kind of bring everybody in so that we don't have to memorize the list of legislation?
Yes, I think so. Although I wanted to say that I do think it's a strength that we've been able to say, come to this demonstration and speak out about whatever you're most concerned about. I also think it's true that I had people say to me, who thought this was that bad things were happening, but who said, "Now, what are you protesting against?" Mm-hmm. And these were people that I thought would know, right. You know, and so I would go through with details. And one of the things I've been doing, but one of the things that said to me, and this is critical, I think, is that people don't really follow the minutiae of state politics. They follow national politics. And so just trying to educate, get people to pay close attention to what is going on. And a lot of these laws have been passed in the middle of the night with very little debate. There's a reason why people are not very clear about exactly what's going on.
Certainly big corporate money has paid attention to state politics. They've realized it's an easy place to get all the legislation they need, and they're pouring money into the state of North Carolina to get lawmakers in office and legislation passed.
And just for that reason is that it's very cost efficient. It doesn't cost very much to get somebody elected to the state legislature.
No, that's it. And only a small bag of money to get the legislation you want.
Right.
Thank you, Jim Black. And you've also talked about the history of this in North Carolina before even the civil rights movement. I was surprised to see that the women's suffrage movement was very strong in the state of North Carolina.
It was very strong. It didn't. North Carolina didn't ratify the suffrage amendment, but it had a very vital suffrage movement. And civil disobedience was very critical to the suffrage movement, not specifically in North Carolina, but nationally it was.
So these are things that worked. More recently, Neil, you know, we saw civil disobedience in the Wake County school controversy. And that was kind of interesting in a way. And I don't know how much of this is correlation and how much of this is cause, but it is interesting that in the very next election cycle, the conservative board shifted and there was suddenly a Democratic majority back in power. Can you link those? Was that any part of what might have happened there in the transfer of power?
Well, certainly one of the ways that sort of movements can be successful besides raising issues and talking to people is by bringing together different coalitions that can then work on electoral politics later on, right? And so as more and more people get involved in the Moral Mondays, I suspect that you'll be seeing new coalitions of people who will think like, okay, so, you know, we got to have to get ready for the next state legislative set of elections. We have to get ready for the next gubernatorial election, and it energizes a group of activists into the electoral politics who might not be focused on state politics. You know, in the last election, a lot of the focus was on President Obama, and sometimes state races get pushed to the side. And to the extent that, again, this is, you know, centering state politics, I imagine it moves a group of people who might otherwise either not, you know, who would potentially be active but don't know where to be active. This moves state politics to the center.
So even if the Moral Mondays didn't continue through the next election cycle, the organizations that get created may have an impact on them. And there are different kinds of organization and different kinds of civil disobedience. Jacqueline, we can talk about the SCLC versus SNCC, for instance, if we go back to the civil rights movement. And that's something that you've paid some attention to.
Well, there was a wide variety of things that people did. The SCLC, Martin Luther King's organization, primarily mobilized big marches. So the Selma March, for example, was a march for voting rights. What often happened is that people wanted to just gather in the street, parade, go down to the office of the government and say their piece, and the local officials would get an injunction against any kind of protest, and people would continue to march, and you had the kind of violent response that you saw in the civil rights movement. SNCC was more focused on organizing at the grassroots and less on big mass demonstrations.
Well, you got, and it was interesting because obviously at the time there were serious debates about which method was the best and most effective. In looking back, historians, and I'll ask you what you think, figure, well, they probably needed every bit of that. And so in part it was mobilizing everybody who was interested and then letting a thousand flowers grow, because in one way or another that all may have contributed.
That's right. And I think that's important for people to realize today, too, is that people sometimes are hesitating to join in these current protests if they don't want to commit civil disobedience, or don't want to risk going to jail. And I try to make really clear to people that while I think that's an important thing for some people to do, that's only one thing. That's only one part of and civil disobedience works only in conjunction with the whole range of other kinds of strategies that are going on at the same time.
Do those strategies, Neil, I'll ask you this first, because those are things you can always do. I'm assuming you mean letters to the editor, letters to your lawmakers, organizing at the local grassroots level to get people out to vote, et cetera. All that's going on. Are there ways to see precisely when it is? What are the triggers for civil disobedience in a democratic society like ours? Are there ways to identify them?
Usually it is when there's a group of people who consider it, who are sort of morally outraged in a way that they'll consider risking arrest, which for many people, you know, is a scary thing. And also sort of an organizational or ideological tradition where you view it as an acceptable means of protest. And so which is why it's more prominent on the left in the U.S. than it is on the right. So going back for the last 80 years or even further, being arrested in this very sort of in the civil disobedience style of sitting down and, you know, continuing your activities while the police tell you to stop is something that people view as part of the – potentially as part of a leftist or a progressive identity, and how you express your moral outrage.
Is there a fundamental shift, though, in the kind of protest, and we'll call it in a very large sense civil disobedience, say pre-World War II and post? I'm thinking about labor organizing and strikes, demonstrations of that kind, which are a kind of disobedience, right? Get back to work. No, not until you fix this. But in those cases, workers were organized on a plant-by-plant or industry-by-industry basis about the grievances that affected them directly. They weren't abstract ideas. They weren't about freedom or the right to vote for all of us. But they're important things, but far more breadbasket material issues. You know, the 60s, people talk about free speech and free sexual expression, and they tend to be students and intellectuals and not workers anymore. Was there a fundamental shift, and does that change the way both the impact and the kind of organizing you do?
I think that it shifted along a huge number of dimensions between, as you mentioned, between sort of material-based protests versus more ideological, potentially, protest. Also, what's changed tremendously is the policing of protests. And so if you look there, there was sort of violent repression often. And now it is much more routine, such that it is fairly common at protests where, you know, there'll be people who, if you'd like to engage in civil disobedience, shift to the left. If you'd like to not be arrested, move to the right. Whereas a long time ago, police would just simply arrest people, right? And so those are particularly the violent images that you see from the civil rights movement or from the earlier during the labor organizing. And part of this is just a response to the routinization of protest. A lot more people are doing it, or in the routinization of civil disobedience. And part of it's just that it is, you know, better policing tactics. They realize that in order to repress the, you know, if you want the protests to go away, violently beating people won't make that happen. That will just draw more attention to the issue.
What about that, Jacqueline, that fundamental shift and how viscerally people are responding to and likely to engage in that kind of protest?
Well, I think that the civil rights movement certainly did bring about a shift in the sense that the civil rights movement has been a model for civil nonviolent protest all over the world. The overthrow of apartheid in South Africa, the Arab Spring, just one thing after the other, has had global influence. So certainly in that sense, it made people aware of and ready to use that tactic. But it, as I said, it has a really long history. The very term civil disobedience goes back to a famous essay of Thoreau's written in the middle of the 19th century in the context of the abolitionist movement. And civil disobedience was absolutely central to the struggle against slavery. So,
well, it's essential to the foundation of the nation, right? I mean, we had to commit treason.
The Tea Party.
We had to commit treason to be here.
The Boston Tea Party.
Right. So, all of that is sort of rooted in our history. At this point, I'm not sure that anybody. It is interesting that nobody argues that you shouldn't be there doing what you're doing, and so I guess it's interesting that our conversation is more about the efficacy rather than the ethics of what it is you're doing. And what about that? The idea that when it was a labor movement, for instance, let's just focus on that, and I was organized and taking risks for my paycheck and my workplace, people are much more likely to get engaged, and perhaps the results are forthcoming, which is why you could imagine why they don't want workers to organize anymore. It worked. It was quite effective to give workers their rights and leverage against capital. Let's never let that happen again. But is it more difficult because these issues tend to be more ideological and less material, have less day-to-day impact on people?
Well, I think it's easy to forget how hard it was to organize the labor movement in the first place. Things always look in retrospect like, oh, okay, well, that would work because it did work.
Yeah.
I think that moral outrage is a very, very powerful force. And I've really noticed how many of the people who are involved in these Moral Mondays, white and black, are coming from the churches and coming out of religious conviction and ideas. And I don't think that bread and butter we don't live by bread alone.
I want to thank you both, Jacqueline Dowd Hall, history professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and Neil, I want to thank you as well. Neil Cairns, a professor of sociology at UNC Chapel Hill. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, there's more to come, the history of civil disobedience and a look at Gandhi after this break. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking about civil disobedience today. And when we think about civil disobedience, at least in our global history, one name that comes to mind is Gandhi. Lila Prasad is a professor of religious studies at Duke University and faculty director of the Duke Center for Civic Engagement. Lila is also working on a documentary film called Moved by Gandhi and joins us now. Lila Prasad, welcome to The State of Things. Thank you
for having me. My pleasure.
Before Mohandas Gandhi became Mahatma Gandhi and an activist and a global leader, he was a legal representative. He was working for the corporate interests of a company in of all places, South Africa.
That's right. And really, that is where his ideas in civil disobedience really get shaped. I mean, he went to South Africa when he was 24 years old. Had a number of experiences there within a week of. Showing up, he did, as you're right, he did. He went there originally to represent the legal interests of a Muslim trading firm and discovered a whole lot of other things going on there. I mean, the most famous incident we know about was in the film Gandhi, the well-known film Gandhi by Attenborough, in which he's thrown out of this train, right? He's going from Durban to Pretoria and possesses a legal first-class ticket, sits in a legal, for first-class compartment. And yet, because he's imagined and thought of as a coolie, which was the derogatory term used for Indian indentured, Indians living in South Africa, some of them at least, and he's thrown out. And what people don't know a whole lot about, and something he writes about even more strongly in his autobiography, which he calls The Experiments with Truth, he's also then beaten up in a stage coach, on that very same journey. So he has, and then he's kicked, into a gutter by a guard when he's walking past the president's house. So he has had these, very shaping experiences
Well, and it might seem obvious to anybody that after those kind of experiences, your moral outrage would be awakened, your social consciousness would be enlivened. But not necessarily. He's working for a trading firm. He's a lawyer. I mean, many, many people endure that and say, look, this is part of the deal. I get paid well. I'm going to keep going here. Was he awakened in that moment, or did he try to rationalize? What happened?
Well, like with everything else that Gandhi did, he was given to a lot of self-reflection, intensive self-reflection. Sometimes it drove people crazy. But he it was a kind of a political awakening for him, because he went there. I mean, he'd spent, and this is colonial South Africa, so this is the whole deal, in a sense. So you can't escape the question, the fundamental question he begins to ask himself in the wake of these experiences. Do I turn back and leave, finish my job and go away, or stay on and do something about it? And he, you know, long process of thinking about it, but he did decide that this was something that he had to fight against, because this was just not about him. It was happening all over the place. And there was much more going on in the other in other parts of South Africa that he, you know, there was legislation that was heavily anti-Indian, and he, you know, organized protests and all that. So there was the environment was rotten.
But again, he didn't go in there with any kind of agenda for changing any of this. So it's interesting that he makes this change. And of course, Experiment in Truth is the foundation. It's the subtitle of it. It's his autobiography. Tell us about that, how he saw truth as central to any kind of engagement of a political process.
That's a really great question. You know, as he gets involved in matters in South Africa, and he's working with different constituencies of Indians out there, he is formulating his own strategy for combating injustice. He works with, you know, he knows about passive resistance. He starts out there and he says, okay, well, this might work. You know, how do you resist injustice? What do you do about it? And he's organizing, talking, writing, you know, a lot of those things that Jacqueline talked about. He's doing those things. And he works with that phrase. And, you know, as he's involved in all these struggles, he's also looking for a term to call that struggle something. He's looking. So he starts out with passive resistance. It doesn't quite fit the bill for him because it doesn't embody the two core principles of that method that comes to be called satyagraha. And I'll say something about that in a second. Yeah. So passive resistance didn't for him capture the sense of, you know, the unflinching commitment that he had to truth. And one can ask, you know, well, what is this particular truth that he's talking about? And the other thing that it didn't quite commit itself to was refusing violence, no matter what.
Right.
Violence. And so.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you said he knew about passive resistance. Where did he know? Where did he get his ideas from?
Gandhi read a lot. You know, and you know, and he read very selectively, though. He had read Tolstoy. He had read, you know, particularly Sermon on the Mount, redone. He had read Plato. He had later, you know, way into these struggles, he had also chanced on Thoreau's, you know, the essay that was mentioned, Civil Disobedience. He'd read all this stuff. So he has an idea. And then there's all, you know, the British government had used passive resistance itself, too. So he was aware of these ideas, but he didn't work very much with passive resistance as an adequate term. He moves on to civil disobedience, which is the term that we've been hearing in the first half of this program, and worked with that for a while. But even that, you know, he's gone on to write about that to say, you know, well, I wasn't that happy with it. I turned to civil resistance. And then eventually in about 1967, you know, he announces a competition for a term that might capture this sense of, you know, what the struggle is about and what the method to actually deal with it is about. And one of the entries of that, you know, he takes an entry that's submitted in this competition and he works with that. He improvises on that and comes up with the term satyagraha.
Which is what? Tell us what that means.
It's a Sanskrit compound.
Yeah.
Satya means truth. You know, and agraha is insistence or firmly holding on to. So it's really, and he's done various translations of it, but they all sort of cohere around the same idea of the force of truth, by the force of truth or an insistence on truth. And he even called it soul force. But this was the kind of force that he wanted to work with. So your question about, you know, the truth, things.
Well, it's an interesting distinction between just using a method like passive resistance, where one sets a goal and then applies a strategy and tactics to that goal. If you're committed to the truth and you're the filter for that truth, it might change. The goal might change. I mean, it was one of the criticisms of Gandhi, is that he frequently changed his mind as his understanding of the truth changed, and then the goal itself might be different.
That has been a major one of the criticisms of Gandhi, as you rightly point out, but it's also been one of the strengths of his method, which is he always provided room for reflection and evolution. In fact, there are very few political leaders one knows about who allow themselves to be scrutinized the way he did, because he subjected himself to that kind of intense self-scrutiny. Any of his readings give you a glimpse into that personality. And so, yes, you know, as he began to study the situation and as he began to hear stories of people and engage them and emote with them, I don't think the nature of truth changed. His commitment to what that truth was grew and refined. And so his strategy sometimes changed along with that. So it was flexible to that extent. But what was absolutely uncompromising is that in the fight for, you know, in the struggle for a cause, you don't waver on the basic truth that you're fighting for. So there may be two sets of laws, right? One of them actually is one that the state has, you know, created to protect the interests of citizens. But another law, like the ones that we are talking about today in our legislature, are completely dehumanizing to human beings. And so he found it possible to actually refuse a law and honor it.
So the Salt March would be the perfect example of this.
The Salt March is one great example of that. You know, this is, you know, pretty late in the in his life, in 1930s, when, you know, the protest there was, you know, the British government had a monopoly over the manufacture and sale of salt and also levied a tax on this. And of course, this hurt the poorest of the poor even more harshly, as always. And so Gandhi said that this was also one symbol that unified Hindus and Muslims and what have you and everyone else. And so this, he also understood the power of symbolism, of course, you know, we know this about Gandhi. And so he organized this, you know, protest, this walk, the Salt March, as it's called, 241 miles, started out from one of his ashrams in Western India, went up to a coastal town, walked for about 15 miles a day. He started out with 78 followers. All of them were men, because he wanted the government, the British government, to have the freedom to arrest these people. And if women were part of that crowd, then that would have restrained them. So what is really interesting about that Salt March, and then he gets to the seashore and then in an act of defiance, you know, makes salt. Because the British are completely baffled by his strategy. They always were baffled by the turns he made. But it was enormously successful on many fronts. But the takeaway from that is that, you know, is the method itself. He informs the government that he's going to do this. He petitions, tries to persuade in other ways, doesn't work. And then he lets them know, I'm going to do this on this day at this time. And you have the full freedom to arrest me because I will be breaking a law. And they do exactly that. So the point of being arrested is that you honor the law, but you also refuse aspects of it that are unjust.
Well, and you absolutely underscore the stupidity of the law itself. You
right.
mean making salt is illegal?
Right.
And you have to scratch your head. And so anyone reading that, particularly if you're back in London saying, what is it that we're doing over there? It would give you pause for a moment.
Right.
Because
right.
he absolutely calls your bluff on this thing. You're taxing salt. Yes, well, it's what we're using to fund the. Oh, no. You're saying we can't make salt.
Right. And he interrogated these actions. You know, the beauty of it was that he got down to the basics very quickly in each of these satyagrahas. Campaigns that he would just really cut to the chase.
Now, that was late in the campaign, as you suggested, early on in the turn of the 20th century when he begins organizing. How effective was he? How successful was he in gaining followers?
You know, the question of success is one that Gandhi tables for us very well, actually. So initially, you know, of course, he had had some experience doing this in South Africa. And when he comes to India in 1914-15, that reputation follows him, that he's vocal, he's, you know, he's articulate. And, you know, this was not the Gandhi who went to South Africa completely tongue-tied. But he's come back with this reputation. And one of the first satyagrahas that he conducts in India is in Bihar, in the central Indian state of today known as Bihar. And it's called the Champaran farmers of that particular district were forced to cultivate indigo. Forfeiting, you know, their means to livelihood, because that was not the, what their lands were supposed to be cultivating. On top of it, the government imposed these heavy taxes, and it, they were just completely driven to sub-poverty levels. And was so he organized, and the way he organized this is actually quite illuminating in the context of what's going on today. You know, the way he was invited to Champaran. He studies the situation. This is one of the first things he does, even when he comes to India. He travels. You know, one of his mentors, Gokhale, tells him, you know, you don't know India. So to protest and to understand India, you better travel. And so he travels by train, village to village, town to town, getting to understand what Indian experience might have been like. And he understands, and he does exactly this with the indigo farmers. He gets to Champaran, understands what's going on in the district, documents the atrocities of people, the sufferings, learns to emote with them. This is why also the documentary film is called Moved by Gandhi, because it is something about the power of emotion that Gandhi understood. It's the humanity of it. And so he instituted a social change program in amongst these indigo farmers, that community. And he says, you know, schools have to be built, hospitals have to be built, and so on and so forth. So the whole idea of civil disobedience in the Gandhian context comes hand in hand with a social work program, with an understanding of the masses, with a deep identification of the disempowered and being in that skin.
How, when you think about his relationship with the political forces, even the those arrayed against the Raj, the Indian National Congress, for instance, there were huge tensions. And at some point, I think that the political leadership realized they couldn't do without Gandhi. And this gets to his personality. To what extent are movements like this dependent on a particular charismatic, perhaps ingenious in the way that they understand symbolism and as you say, emotion? Are they critical to movements like this?
I think, well, the Arab Spring is a great example of, you know, who's the leader, who's the moving force behind. I think to jumpstart something, it's helpful to have an identifiable leader. And Gandhi was, of course, charismatic, you know, maximally so. But once the movement catches on, and Neil said something about this, and it acquires its own moral tempo and its own moral force, and that's what drives it. It's not so much a personality, although Gandhi's story is a little different. You know, he was able to stop crazy rioting in the 1940s, just at the, on the, you know, around the time of independence by going on a 3-day fast, which completely stopped this crazy killing that was happening. So Gandhi is a little bit different in that. But I think in general, your question, you know, I think they are galvanized by exemplars and inspired by them. But then the inspiration, the source of inspiration is the moral work.
Often we see, and certainly I think it can be argued in the case of Gandhi with his assassination, that the kind of moral quality that he brought to the revolution almost immediately dissolves in the aftermath of independence in some ways. I mean, I don't know if that's a fair characterization, but certainly it didn't have that kind of moral center without him. I mean, is that something that we're going to have to endure, that movements get started by these individuals, but ultimately politics being politics, they can't sustain at that level of moral integrity?
Dismally speaking, I think you're right. You know, I mean, I think that's what happens, what we see happening all world over, that the, once the moral center dissolves, then much else dissolves with it. But time has shown that moral centers come up again and again, you know, and it's usually through the work of citizenship. Citizens who feel collective outrage and transform their societies, find a moral center and make it and sustain it, you know. The interesting thing about Gandhi was that, you know, in his satyagraha campaigns, it was not enough to achieve an objective, which may be this act or that legislation, but its success consisted in two things. One was the moral transformation that it had to induce in the opponent. So in our case, it could be the governor and all the legislators who would have to themselves go through a transformation to understand what those laws are actually going to be doing to people, you know, with a history and a place.
Kind of like King's comment that we're going to love the hell out of them.
Right, right,
and
exactly.
That transformation would be a brand new person. Lila Prasad, so good to talk with you. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Lila Prasad is a professor of religious studies at Duke University and faculty director of the Duke Center for Civic Engagement. Thank you for listening. If you want to know more about this show, our website is stateofthings.org, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.